Right, so
This is going to be Dr. Hera's podcast number six.
Number six.
So I'm Julian Lasso, and I'm here with my friend and colleague, Dr. David Hindmarsh. And we're going to be discussing... we didn't do a Dr. Hera's podcast last month because things got rather busy. Originally, we weren't going to be discussing loads of stuff about coronavirus, stroke, COVID-19, because we got everybody sick of that.
Yeah.
But in fact, there isn't, if you look at the medical journals at the moment, there isn't anything else discuss,
it's
really.
It's just COVID or nothing.
There isn't anything else in medicine to discuss. No. So we are going to discuss...
just for a change.
Yes, coronavirus and COVID-19.
Yeah.
So, would you care to kick off with some stuff from the BMJ, I think, been looking at?
Yes, this is a... Do you want the number for this? This is BMJ 2020 369.M1577.
Right.
And this is about reusing PPE, and it's something to do with public, the public health people and things like that.
So, public health guidance.
So they're saying, and this applies to the hospital as well, and they're sort of suggesting that it's all right to use aprons instead of gowns.
Yeah.
But in fact, it's not quite sure that the Public Health England and the WHO agree with this. And then they're talking about reusing masks, the FFP3 and the FFP2.
Yeah.
And if they're not damaged then or soiled, then you can reuse them.
Yeah. So you kind of have to fold them up so the bit that you've breathed into is kind of
on the
inside.
Yes. I'm not quite sure how you do that with those big ones that make your nose look like a...
look like a duck's bill.
Yes, that's right. There's a lot of origami involved in that.
And keep them in a sealable bag.
Yes, that's right, because everyone carries a sealable bag around.
Of course, sandwich bag all the time.
Yeah, and then they're saying it's okay to use lab coats, which is all right for Christina, our healthcare assistant, because she always wears a lab coat.
Because she's got one.
Yes. But I think you are supposed to wash it occasionally. Or long sleeve patient gowns. So you have to scour the hospital for a patient who's wearing a long sleeve gown, take it off them, and then you're safe. But you might get arrested. And then there's the... then there's the balancing. What they're saying about this is that actually, if you think that the PPE is not sufficient to protect you, and say for instance you're trying to do a resuscitation on a patient or something like that, as long as you write a contemporaneous record of it, say, "Well, I don't want to do this because I think this is more
making process.
It's too much risk." To not just the patient, but to the doctor and everyone else standing around.
Right.
Then you might get away with it with the GMC.
Yeah.
But so it's all a bit of a difficult balance, really.
Yes.
Are you safe, or is it safe to see the patient? And what's your first duty? Do you need to? Is your first duty to your patient?
Yes.
That sort of thing.
But also the safety goalposts have been moved, haven't they?
Yes.
Because the guidance on what is deemed to be safe protective equipment...
Yes, yeah.
The supply of protective equipment has been a big bone of contention.
Yes,
Right the way throughout this crisis.
Yeah,
it's been
definitely.
Very well sort of visited by the press and by the political parties.
Yes.
But I think probably what's been less well visited is the way in which they've kind of... changed the advice about what is suitable for protective equipment as the shortages have become more apparent. So,
yes, that's interesting, isn't it?
And I mean, there's past history of this in that we've kind of seen it with child immunisations, haven't we? Where a certain child immunisation would become difficult to get hold of, and so they'd say, actually, you can use this other one instead.
There's got three other vaccines in it as well.
So they do tend to kind of temper their advice about certain things in accordance to what's actually available.
Yes, that's true.
And that does seem to be what they've done about PPE to some extent.
Yes, exactly, yes.
Because when we first started with this, the kind of FP3 mask was the gold standard of masks.
Yes.
And very quickly it was kind of, no, you can't get the FP3s. FP2 is every bit as good as FP3. Yes. Don't worry about the FP3s.
Yeah, that's right. And
it was gowns. Everybody's got to have a gown.
Yeah.
All the nurses wanted to have gowns.
Yes.
And then it was, no, you don't really need a gown. No. Well, first of all, it was disposable gowns. You maybe have a disposable gown. And then it was, no, actually, an apron's fine for the likes of you.
And if you have a gown, you've got to wash it.
Yes, that's
even
right.
If it's made of paper.
Yes.
Well, you treat it with ultraviolet light, don't you?
So that's what, according to Donald Trump, that's how you actually treat yourself. You've got coronavirus, so that must be the stuff, that ultraviolet light.
Yes.
So they've redefined what safe is.
Yes, that's
by
true.
Issuing redefinition of the guidance. And it does kind of come across as actually what we're saying is this is what's available, so that's what you've got to make do with.
Yes, it's true. Yeah, I think because this other article, I don't know if I can find the number for this. Yes, it's 369M1391, and it's one of the interesting things in here is that it says that you should consider the type of protection that you wear subject to local risk assessment.
Yeah.
So what does that mean?
It means in the place where you're standing.
Yes.
If there's somebody coughing and spluttering directly in your direction.
And if so.
Or is somebody trying to rip your protective equipment off you.
Yeah. Yeah, that, I think that's what
it is. In order to sell it on eBay.
Yes, exactly. Yes, so, but it's...
There's been quite a lot of... you mentioned about the fact that you're supposed to make a sort of contemporaneous note of your decision-making process.
Yes,
and there's been quite a lot of talk of people saying, well, if we haven't got the right protective equipment, we're not going to see patients.
Yes, yes.
But in fact, that hasn't happened, I don't think.
No, it probably hasn't, no.
And you are between a rock and a hard place, basically, because it's kind of, you know, it's either just give up on patient care and say,
no, we can't do it because it's too much risk.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's very difficult for healthcare professionals to do, I think.
Yes. Well, if you've gone into that line of work thinking, I'm going to help people.
Yes.
That's what I said at my interview at King's years ago, and the bloke said, you should join the Salvation Army then.
Really?
Yeah, no, I made that up. So should we do another one?
Have
we got anything else to say about people?
Well, but we've got a couple of others that are about kind of changing guidance or you wonder where the guidance comes from.
Yes.
Because as I was saying to you, when the government do their sort of daily coronavirus updates, it's always introduced with a little sort of patter that goes along the lines of, all the way through this, we've taken a step-by-step process dealing with the crisis, and at every step, we've based our actions on the best available scientific advice.
Yes.
And in fact, if you look at some of the advice, it doesn't look as if it is based purely on science.
No.
It's based on other things.
Yes.
Some of it's political.
Yeah. Yeah.
And some of it is you know, down to issues of availability. And what conditions, you know, we're working with at the moment.
Yes,
so it's not
exactly
all just about... So, you had another one that was about...
the self-isolation thing, yes. What it was saying is that There was a group of public health experts who said that the 7-day self-isolation is too short, and apparently the World Health Organization says 14 days after symptoms resolved and 2 negative tests. Well, you probably don't end up getting a test.
You're dead by the time that happened. Yeah. 2 negative tests and resolved symptoms.
You can't go yet because we haven't done a second test. Anyway, they say that the risk of infection range is somewhere between 10 and 24 days from symptom onset.
Right.
But this is just experts, so we just don't know. Really.
So is there any kind of counter-argument advanced by the government to say why they've decided to go to 7 days?
No, there isn't really in this. No, there isn't in this.
In that little article.
It's a very short article. But it also queries the indicators of having the virus as well, because they say in other countries, they might include myalgia, fatigue, sore throat, and shortness of breath as indicators. But I suppose the shortness of breath is, you know, part of the process over here, isn't it?
Yeah.
But just as a worsening indicator. So I think really what it shows is there's just a lot of uncertainty.
Mm.
We probably just don't know enough at the moment.
And no, well, that's true. Mm. But you do wonder where this kind of 7-day thing came from.
It must have come from somewhere, mustn't it?
Yeah.
From probably experience elsewhere, I would have thought, maybe.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. So so our current guidance is that if you've had COVID symptoms. I mean, yes. we're now getting into a scenario where if you've had COVID symptoms, you go and get yourself tested and find out whether you think it actually is COVID or not.
Yes.
But up until very recently, it was kind of, have you had symptoms suggested of COVID-19?
Yes.
And if so, then what you do is you give it 7 days.
Yes.
So you're the carrier, you give it 7 days.
Yeah.
And if your symptoms have resolved,
you
can go back to work after 7 days. But everybody else who's in your household or has been in intimate contact with you should self-isolate for 2 weeks to see whether they're going to start developing the symptoms.
And then wait a week after that.
And then they can go back to work.
Yes. But if you're a healthcare worker, you'd probably get a test then to say if it's negative, you can go to work.
Yeah.
And then have another test and it's positive.
Yeah, well, that's the other issue.
Yes, yeah.
Yes. So, yeah. And the other thing was the change in guidance about ibuprofen, which is also...
Yes, that was another very short article, really.
Which is a bit less vexed from the sort of political point of view, but
yes. Well, it was the French who did the original, you know, we don't like it because, you know, it can cause this cytokine storm or something. I think cytokines, I'm not sure at all now.
Right.
But, increase the risk of dying if you've got COVID.
Yes.
It
wasn't the idea that the ibuprofen... it represses the inflammation, and inflammation is actually part of your body's way of coping with an infection. So if you repress the inflammation, you're actually repressing the body's sort of antiviral
affecting
response.
The immune system in a negative way.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
I think that was... Yeah. That was as I understood it, anyway.
Yeah, well, we'll stick with that.
Okay.
That one, okay. Okay. Anyway, what they're saying is there's no published evidence
about
the change in NICE that's saying you can take ibuprofen for fever and headaches.
Mm.
And we've got one patient who's been advised she can take ibuprofen, and she possibly had COVID. But the evidence hasn't been published, but it's part of the NICE is saying that it's quite possible that you can take it without any harm.
Yeah.
But we just don't know again, really. What we do know is you can't get a paracetamol anywhere.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. Again, there was a question of kind of availability, wasn't there?
Yes.
When this ibuprofen question came up,
yes,
it was highlighted largely because you couldn't get paracetamol.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden there's this advice that says, well, you shouldn't take ibuprofen either.
No.
Right. And people not unreasonably, why am I supposed to take it?
Yes, exactly. But there was another one. There was another article that was saying that the NICE guidelines. This is really good for NICE guidelines, this one. This is 369M1409. And it says, honey is good for coughs. So it's,
right.
So you should have honey if you've got some coronavirus. If you haven't got any paracetamol and you're frightened of taking ibuprofen, open the window and lie face down, because lying face down is a good position to be in for coughing, apparently.
Well, they turn people over before they put them on the respirator, don't they? Before they intubate them.
Oh, do they?
So I gather, yeah.
In the
intensive care units.
Right.
Right, so you're lying face down.
Yeah,
with the window
open the window, because then it's a cool room.
Right.
So that'll lower your temperature.
Right.
And then you can, if you do relaxation, exercises or breathing techniques.
Right.
You know, like counting your breath or breathing in and breathing out.
That's a good technique.
Yes.
it's one I've always played.
To breathe in again, though. And the other one is oxygen. You know, I'm not sure where you're going to find oxygen cylinder in your home, but it's part of the process anyway.
In the cupboard next to the honey.
Yeah. There was an interesting picture of somebody lying down with their foot sticking out of the bottom of the bed.
Not with their foot sticking out of the open window.
No, they're too dangerous. I think the idea was that the foot was facing downwards rather than upwards.
Oh, right, okay.
Was a clue.
Right.
Yes. So,
so that's NICE guidance, is it, of how to...
Yeah, that's the shortest NICE guidance I've ever written.
How to deal with respiratory difficulties.
I think they are trying to do some shortened versions that, you can pick up some... good ideas from.
Yeah, what? Take paracetamol.
Yes.
Stop making such a fuss.
Yes.
Okay, well, that's kind of good.
So that's that.
Excellent.
What do we do next? Oh, there's some other ones here. There's a bit about testing and... we've done the self-isolation.
Yeah, there was one about Germany and why their mortality rates seem to be much lower than the mortality rates.
Yeah, that is quite interesting.
Not just in the UK, but elsewhere in Europe.
Yes. Well, apparently, do you want to do that one now?
Yeah, why not?
All right, well, they did have a low mortality rate, 187 deaths from... 73,000 roughly cases, confirmed cases. So that's a 1.2% conversion rate.
Yes, well, I was interested to see that, because when the sort of coronavirus crisis started, that was the kind of death rate they were quoting as being,
that's true.
That this is going to be the likely death rate. It's going to be sort of somewhere between 1-2%.
Yes.
I can remember saying that in one of our previous podcasts, I think.
Yeah.
And although it was all very uncertain at that stage.
Yes.
But the death rates they're quoting outside of Germany.
Yes.
Are much more alarming than that. You know, Italy 11.9%.
Yes. Yeah, and Spain 9%, Holland 8.6%, the UK 8%, and 7.1% in France.
Yeah, so those are really quite high death rates.
Yes, they are. But it's, I suppose you have to consider the high risk. A large proportion of those will be in high-risk people.
I suppose so, yeah. But if that's kind of all the numbers of coronavirus, confirmed coronavirus cases...
Yes.
I wonder if that's if the thinking is that you know, we probably don't really know, have really not got any idea of how many people actually have coronavirus.
I think that's part of it, yes, because there'll also be asymptomatic people as well.
Yeah,
I think that's what they were saying. The German, you know, the in Germany.
Yeah.
I mean, they did still doing a lot of testing, and they're not just doing it in central laboratories. They are, you know, they're sharing it out with
yes,
you know, all over the country, in, you know, proven laboratories, but not national, you know, nationally driven.
Well, again, that's one of the interesting things. I mean, you know, this has been another vexed question. So there's been a big political issue about the supplies of protective equipment, and an equally big political issue about
why aren't we
testing more? And there's been sort of there hasn't really been very much analysis of how the government's inability to ramp up and roll out, to use the terminology, testing.
Yeah.
As related to the kind of the infrastructure of public health and labs. There was some talk about they couldn't get the reagents.
Yes, that's true.
But you and I did a thing about the pharmaceutical shortages.
Yes.
And how various different types of pharmaceuticals suddenly becoming unavailable very often relates to the fact that the production of these pharmaceuticals has been outsourced either to other parts of Europe or to China or third world countries.
Exactly.
And so the supply chains are much further away from the UK than they used to be.
Yes. Yeah.
And my impression is that the same thing to some extent is probably true of the testing capability, that a lot of the kind of, you know, they make the point that in Germany the labs are more spread out throughout the country.
Yes,
they don't have like a big centralized lab, whereas in the UK in the early parts of the coronavirus thing it was all in Colindale, wasn't it?
Yes, that's
and
right.
Then they spread it out into a few more labs.
Yes,
but they didn't have the kind of the infrastructure in place to allow them the capacity to increase testing and get it all done in all the labs across the country.
No.
And it's quite unclear why that is, but you kind of get the impression that it's...
Maybe we haven't got many labs around. That,
we just haven't got the stuff in place in this country anymore to just be able to
yes,
turn it to this new purpose when that becomes urgently needed.
Yes, I thought there was something about there are quite a lot of private labs.
Yeah,
but they're not considered to be acceptable standard for doing the testing.
Well, there was certainly a story in the Guardian about the fact that there were quite a lot of research laboratories in universities, which initially Public Health England didn't seem to want to utilise.
Yeah.
And there was a suggestion that there were maybe different ways of doing the testing
that,
again, Public Health in England weren't very happy with.
Yeah, because they're almost like, you know, home testing kits you can get now. It's like a pregnancy test, apparently.
Yeah, well, that was another issue. The fact that I think the UK government felt that the way to get around the testing thing would be to buy in, bulk buy these testing kits, which I think they got from the USA, which were going to be the antibody testing kits, which find out whether you have already had the virus or not.
Yes.
And then they turned out not to be, you know, not to be any good.
Right.
So they had, I don't know how many of these things,
but
billions of them. There was this big announcement that you were going to be able to get them from Amazon, or Amazon were going to deliver them, which was immediately denied.
Yeah.
No, that's not going to be the case. It all happened in one day, early in March.
Yeah.
And I think that what was going on behind the scenes was that they got all these testing kits and they realised that they weren't actually reliable. The percentage of correct tests wasn't high enough to... Yeah. So I mean, and in a way that probably reflects the government's strategy to kind of try to buy in a one size fits all solution instead of to try to get it done in all these different centres all around the country.
Yeah. Yes, well, that's certainly what they do in Germany. Lots, you know, 500,000 of these, the gold standard tests. I can't remember what all the initials stand for now. I think it's something about retroviral or something or other.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
but the Germany is now concerned that, you know, there might be, you know, another lot with higher fatality now.
Yeah.
Because they haven't had any outbreaks in care homes, but then that's one of the highest risk things that they're looking out for.
Yes, yeah, so this is slightly old, of course, from the BMJ.
Yes.
A week or two ago.
Yes.
And it's all based on quite old. I think they have had outbreaks in care homes
sure
now.
Yeah.
But yes. But yeah, I mean, they are starting to, and of course, this is a big concern all round. That as you start to take the social restrictions,
yes, yeah,
is there going to be a resurgence of the virus?
Yeah, it's another thing we just don't know for certain.
No, and again, the government is kind of taking a bit of a big technology approach to this, because part of their answer is we'll get everybody to have the app. Which is, you know about this app?
No.
Everybody's supposed to get this app on their smartphone.
Right, yeah.
And what happens is, it basically relies on people who've got the app to say, I've got COVID-19. So they put it in, but the app knows the whereabouts of every other person who's also got the app via Bluetooth technology.
Oh, I see.
So as soon as you put it onto your smartphone that you have got COVID-19.
Yeah.
It will alert anybody else who's been in your vicinity, who has also got the app, that they ought to self-isolate. So it's contact tracing via technology.
Yeah, well, that's clever.
And apparently if they can get up to about, I'm not sure if it's 60% of the population or 60% of people with smartphones, which would be a subset of the population.
Yeah.
But if they can get up to 60% or whatever, then it will become a real kind of, you know, a goer from the point of view of actually, tracing part of the testing and tracing.
Because that's what they did in South Korea, wasn't it?
Well, they certainly had an app in South Korea, and I imagine it was a similar sort of thing.
And then they knew that people had been in contact, and then they said, you've got to self-isolate.
Yeah.
Probably for 2 weeks.
Yeah. Or maybe for 1 week, who knows?
Depending if they've got a headache or not.
But, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, should we look at that one about the... because mention of South Korea kind of brings us to the business about the... are the costs of tackling COVID-19 worth the benefits?
Yes.
Which is... so this is BMJ again. This is BMJ issue 369 M1496. And it's called Tackling COVID-19. Are the costs worth the benefits? And it's, it doesn't come out with any answers, but it's just an interesting perspective.
Sort of ethics and stuff like that.
Yeah.
How you balance things.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it starts by making the point that, it seems outrageous. I mean, it seems outrageous to be saying, you know, is it actually worth it?
Yes.
To put all the effort in.
Yeah.
To have all these social restrictions.
Yeah.
Out all this lockdown, it's going to cost the country a fortune. It already has cost the country a fortune.
Yes.
And is it worth it in terms of the number of lives that are saved? So that seems like an outrageous thing to ask.
Yes. How do you value a life?
You don't value a life, but it makes the point at the beginning of this article that in fact you're making decisions like that all the time in running a health service based on, you know, a constrained supply of money, which is based on taxation.
Yeah.
You haven't got an infinite amount to spend, so you're constantly saying, you know, for things like expensive new drugs for cancer treatments.
Yeah.
That's what NICE is for,
yes,
to try to work out this, is it worth
cost
it?
Effective? That's right,
And in fact, you made the point that the government strategy has not been to, hasn't been to prevent loss of life, It's been to prevent an NHS meltdown.
Yeah, I think that's been the idea of it, what's gone on in this country.
Yeah,
which is understandable because you don't want it to be overwhelmed and, you know, people can't get to, you know, any care that's needed.
Yeah, so that's been the driving force, really. It's been to, you know, we can't allow it to reach the point at which our health service simply can't cope with the throughput.
Yes, and there's quite a lot of figures in here, weren't there?
But yes,
something like there were 120,000 cases, and
up to April 19th. So again,
there was about 16,000 deaths out of that number.
Yeah, we're now getting towards 30,000 deaths, aren't we?
Yeah, and then they were talking about, you know, that a proportion of these would have died from other causes as well. And then, you know, the figures are very complicated, and the writing's very small.
Yes.
But it was about half a, you know, if you do nothing, then it could be up to 500,000 deaths attributable to COVID over 2 years.
Yes.
But and then if you look at the deaths in 2018, it's over 500,000.
Yes.
So
I mean, this is one of the things that they keep saying about comparing countries with countries.
Yes.
The only, and I think this article says it somewhere, that the only realistic way of, because you don't really know how many coronavirus crisis cases you've got, COVID-19 cases, because you also don't really know how many people have died of COVID-19 much of it depends what's put on the death certificate.
Yeah, exactly.
And certainly outside hospital, that can be pretty hit and miss.
Well, that's true, isn't
so,
it?
Yeah. So the only realistic way of measuring it is how many extra deaths have we had in the course of a 12-month or 2-year period as against what you would normally expect. And then once you compare country to country, because this is another thing, it's very difficult to know how the accuracy of our COVID-19 death reporting compares to the accuracy of COVID-19 reporting in another country.
That's true,
how does their death certificate system work?
Yeah.
How sort of keen are they to put COVID-19 as a cause of death on there?
Yeah.
And how does that feed through into their statistics?
Yeah.
You don't know. So until you've got these kind of big global numbers about total deaths and how that compares to what the normal totals were like before COVID-19 came along, you can't really tell how much impact it's had and how one country compares to another country.
No, that's true, yeah. The other bit about this was they were suggesting that the interventions such as school closure, self-isolation, lockdown, social distancing, banning of public events, blah, 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 plus treatments, deaths from COVID could be reduced from what they said could be, you know, 500,000 to 250,000 in that 2-year period. But, you know, it's difficult to measure, isn't it, really?
There are a lot of figures being bandied around.
I know, and I think they're saying there was an article in the BMJ, which I didn't really read, apart from a headline, about modelling systems, how they, you know, they estimate, you know, what's going to happen when and how many are going to die and so on and so on. And they're saying that they don't seem to be very accurate.
No, and that was one of the criticisms that's been levelled at the government's approach, and particularly at the point where they seem to be going for a herd immunity option, was that they seem to be very wedded to modelling as opposed to, you know, so the idea of, you know, this is where what the curve looks like, and perhaps if this happens, then the curve will be like this, and if that happens, then the curve will be like that, as opposed to, an old-fashioned, we've got a big illness out here, we've got to intervene to do something to fix it.
Yeah.
And there has been, yeah, I mean, there certainly has been a lot of talk about graphs and modelling and stuff. Yes,
that's true.
And that does seem to be, and so partly that is, presumably, that's coming from the scientific advisors to some extent.
Yeah, it must be, yes, yeah.
But the other thing they make is, the other point they make in this article is that you know, we're just starting to get some idea of the health impact of the lockdown.
Yes, that is true. So, suicides and...
And of course, a lot of people not wanting to come forward, even though they're having, you know, health difficulties, heart attacks or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I can't go to hospital at the moment or I'll catch COVID-19.
Yes, exactly.
Or, you know, your two-week wait cancer referral rates are plummeting, but people have still got those symptoms, but they're not coming forward with them because they're worried about...
And it's also difficult for the hospitals to fit them in within the 2 weeks.
Well, that's the other thing. Yeah. The stuff which is, I mean, they've shelved all non-essential hospital procedures.
Yes. Yeah.
You won't get your hip replacement or your knee replacement. No. But they've also shelved quite a lot of stuff which is probably really quite important.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Quite a lot of investigations that might lead to important surgery. Yeah. So that and as you say, there's been a big impact on health.
Yeah.
And as the sort of financial implications of the lockdown unfold, that in itself will have big knock-on implications for people's health.
Yes, it will do. Absolutely. There'll be another surge of other illness not COVID related.
Yeah.
And then there's the domestic violence as well, isn't there?
Yeah, so, absolutely, yes.
You know, there's a lot of stuff connected to what we're doing to try and prevent, you know...
To prevent this surge.
Yeah, to flatten the curve.
And there's been and again, we won't really know what the full consequences are until several years down the road, I wouldn't think.
No. Well, maybe it'll be finished by the end of June. You never know.
You never know.
No.
But it's been—I mean, it's been interesting that you know, that one of the things that impressed me. I mean, first of all, it's difficult to it's difficult to blame the government for not kind of getting the hang of how big this coronavirus crisis was.
Yeah.
It's difficult to blame them because we didn't either. You and I sat here going, you know, is this going to be another one like Zika virus?
Swine flu.
Complete load of rubbish. And you know, you have these virus scares.
Yeah.
Once every few years, there's a big virus scare.
Yeah.
And up until now, you know, you've had Ebola, but Ebola never became a big thing in this country.
No.
And, you know, you've had SARS and so forth, but those MERS, but they never became big things in this country either.
No.
This is the first one that's really hit us.
Yes, well, it is, you know, we're not used to it.
So it caught us all with our trousers down. You can't blame the government for, you know, so you, and to their benefit, to their merit, I suppose.
Yeah.
It was surprising that the alacrity with which they ditched free market ideology and went for state control, state intervention in a massive way.
Yes.
And you know, so we're gonna take charge of this situation, and we're gonna not just take charge of this situation, but put billions of pounds into supporting the economy because we acknowledge how crippling this lockdown is going to be for the economy.
Yeah.
And having this furlough scheme and all the rest of it.
Yes.
So that's really, and I think that's partly because Boris Johnson wants to be Churchill.
Right.
So he thinks in terms of what happened in the Second World War.
Yes, he does think of it as a war, doesn't he? Yeah.
And you had a planned economy, so we'll have a planned economy.
Yeah.
But, you know, credit to them, that was the right thing to do.
Well, it gives hope to people, doesn't it? Knowing that there's some money available.
Yes.
And if they're running a small business, they can...
They won't necessarily just go under and nobody's going to... be making any attempt to keep them going.
Yeah, you have to give him credit for that, really.
But the problem is there's going to be another big bill to pay, like there was in the last recession.
Yeah.
And who's going to pay it further down the road? Because the people that paid the big bill in the last recession were, you know, we've had 10 years of austerity.
Yeah.
And the people that the cutbacks, the people that were targeted by the cutbacks, are the same people that we're now relying on to get us through this crisis.
Yes.
The health service, the social care services.
Yes, well, that will happen probably, yes.
Which is, you know, so, well, it will happen if people keep voting Tory government. but the lesson of this crisis should surely be, if you keep cutting back on your essential services in favour of of the money-making sections of society, you know, we need more entrepreneurship and less less public services, less tax, then you just whittle away at your public services till the point comes when you get a crisis like the one that we've got.
Yeah.
It's really, you're really asking a lot for the public services to step up and look after it.
Well, I think that's true, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
So there, that's nice. So I think we'd probably let me for the next Prime Minister. Well, so should we talk about this?
This is quite an interesting
death of NHS staff from COVID-19.
Yes, yeah.
So this comes from an online journal called the HSJ, which I hadn't even heard of. But the article was sent to us by our friend Hans van Sloon, who he must subscribe to this, I suppose. And this was put together by three leading clinicians.
Yes.
It says at the beginning of the article, I think, that a couple of them were collecting individually,
yes, that's right.
Separately from each other. They were trying to collect statistics on how many people in the NHS were dying from COVID-19.
Yeah.
And their way that they did this was via social media and news reports.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So it's not kind of official statistics.
No.
But when they found out about each other's research, they were doing this separately, and they kind of cross-verified, and they've done everything that they can to try to authenticate the figures
they've got. Yeah, it was well done for, you know, because you can't imagine there's a massive funding for this at all.
No.
They've just decided to do it.
Yeah. And the figures that they've come up with are very interesting.
Yeah.
So do you want to...
Well... Well, I said there were 119 cases identified of people who worked for the NHS and died. the 98 of them, they sort of whittled it down a bit to 106 from the 119, because there was some of the information wasn't quite
clear. They couldn't verify, yeah.
Yeah, so... But 98 of those had patient-facing roles. And then they looked at the... this is all the variables they were looking at. Do that one. And then they were looking at the numbers.
Yeah, unfortunately, my printout's slightly wonky.
Yeah, it is a bit wonky.
But one of the interesting things was that...
We should look at GPs.
Yes.
Where are the GPs going?
I think in their actual sort of write-up, they say that there were among the doctors, the specialities involved were surgery, five cases, general practice, four, emergency medicine and medicine, each two, and one each from histopathology, geriatrics, neuro-rehabilitation, paediatrics and psychiatry.
Yeah.
There were no anaesthetists or intensivists identified, and they make the point that the intensive care, there were no deaths recorded during the period when they were doing this research of either doctors or nurses in intensive care.
Right.
They wonder if that's because people in intensive care are much more practiced and rigorous in their use of
donning
PPE.
Donning and doffing and stuff like that. Yeah.
We've got a member of staff whose sister works in intensive care in William Harvey.
Yeah.
And she says that the real reason for it is because they're not allowed to release the information.
Yeah, that's right.
But she is the same person who told us that Boris Johnson was definitely dead. So, and I would think that, I think, having thought about that, I think that the death of somebody who works in intensive care would come out, whether they wanted it to come out or not come out. They couldn't hush it up.
No.
So it may be that you're not allowed to sort of make a big thing out of it, but I think that would come out one way or another.
You'd expect it to. I mean, but you don't. You can't be sure how accurate these figures are.
No, that's right. But one of the other interesting things they said was how closely the kind of proportion of deaths in the NHS followed the proportion of deaths in the
general population.
In the general public.
Yeah, that's
overall.
Right. Yeah.
And also the figures
so
about
no greater, no less. Yeah.
Yeah, and but also the figures about black and ethnic minority
deaths
which are proportionally much higher in the population at large.
Yes.
The proportional difference within the NHS is almost exactly the same.
Yeah.
So that's a very interesting thing as well.
Because
you would think that people, I mean, a lot, and in fact, a lot of the kind of narrative, if you like, of how heroic the NHS has been.
Yeah.
You would think that people working at the coalface.
Yeah.
Are at a much higher risk.
Yeah,
and
that's
would be
right.
likely to die in higher numbers.
Yes, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
It is relatively
small numbers, but even so, it's, you know,
pretty, it's very interesting.
Yeah. The vast majority of the people, of the doctors who died, were male and older. Older than the younger people.
So general practitioners quite high up the list of the types of doctors to die. Males who are older, extremely likely to die.
I think it's just because there are more general practitioners in the countries than surgeons.
That'll be it.
Yes. And it's certainly more than histopathologists. So there we are. I think the other thing about this article is it's big type and it's easy to read.
Well, that's very important.
It's a big plus, that. So this is the ethnic minority.
It's going to be very interesting to the, you know, it's very, you know, there's a suggestion that black and ethnic minority individuals get pushed into difficult situations in the NHS.
Yeah.
And in society at large, they tend to be more socially deprived. They probably have worse health outcomes because they're poorer, etc., etc.
Yes.
But I mean, it's also people born elsewhere in Europe, it seems to be. And it's...
Yeah.
You just wonder whether there's something genetic going on in the background
There could easily be, couldn't there? I think that's, you know, there is some
suggestion. But it's all kind of, it's all kind of suggestion at this stage, and it's the science is very sort of vague.
Yeah. A lot of them, you know, was it minimum 56% of these healthcare workers who died were not born in this country? Overall rate of fatalities compared to the population. The absence of these members of staff considered a high risk of, that's the ones about the anaesthetist, isn't it?
Yeah.
So they weren't there at all.
Yeah.
34% of patients admitted to UK intensive care were
black and ethnic minority.
Minority, yeah. So, but only 17% of the UK population. So there surely must be a genetic link there somewhere.
Well,
or something.
It could be the social deprivation thing, but it's going to be, you know, again, we're only going to know.
Probably
several years from now. They're
saying the same happens in the USA.
Yeah.
They're saying it could be some
genetic susceptibility. Or sociological, due to employment and working patterns.
And then there's a particularly high risk in Filipino staff in the NHS. So they're saying there needs to be a government inquiry about this. Yeah, and then we're back to the one about the, you know, the higher risk people, which you'd think would be the ones in intensive care, the lower mortality.
Yeah.
Healthcare staff are rigorous about their, you know, personal protective equipment. But the other thing is, how old are the super duper anaesthetists who are so clever and work in intensive care?
They're very, very old indeed.
They'd be very young to be that clever.
Well, yeah, they anaesthetise themselves. Like Rip Van Winkle, right. And wake up 200 years later.
Yes, okay.
It's part of their training.
Well, that must be the answer then.
Yeah.
Okay, we've sorted that one out.
Okay. Yeah. Well. Well, I think that's probably that's probably pretty much all we've got to say about that.
The other thing they admit there's some bias, possible bias in their, you know, in their figures and everything.
Mm.
Did these people pick up the infection from home rather than work?
Yeah.
We just don't know.
Yeah.
But I wondered about the, you know, whether they're talking about the. The people who are paid less in the NHS are probably at higher risk.
You've put cleaners,
Put cleaners, because you know the virus is in feces and urine and other things.
So your poor old cleaner comes in,
and
sweeps up after all these consultants of people have finished doing their job.
Yes,
in their full protective equipment, the old cleaner comes in wearing nothing at all.
Yeah, and there could be virus all over the floor and things like that. So,
should we lastly just do this one about the...
Let's do that.
Because this is about the, old people's homes, basically.
Yes, yeah.
Neglect of social care during the pandemic. So this is... BMJ again, and this is M1465, and it's called COVID-19, Why We Need a National Health and Social Care Service.
Yes.
But it's, it's topical in a way, because, now we're in sort of phase two of the crisis.
Yes, that's become one of the big focuses, hasn't it?
What's going on in care homes.
Yes.
And in the early stages of the crisis, what's going on in care homes was pushed to one side, not to say swept under the carpet, because the statistics for deaths in care homes didn't feature in the national statistics until, you know, halfway through, the latter part of March, they started incorporating them.
Yes.
And the guidance for personal protective equipment in care homes was completely different to what the guidance for personal protective equipment is in other healthcare settings.
Yeah, social care has been a low priority for personal protective equipment, despite the high risks for residents and staffs, or staff even.
Yes, and people were being discharged from hospital
with
people
COVID.
Who'd had COVID-19 still had it into residential care homes without any proper notification process.
No, but that is the regulation now is they will have been tested and they'll be informed.
Yeah. So it's really, they've become the kind of the new sort of front, if you like, of the... Because it is starting to get into care homes, and if it gets into care homes, which is something people have been saying from the beginning, if it does get into care homes, it knocks people down like ninepins if it starts to go from resident to resident.
Yes, that's really in a way that's they did bring in the non-visiting quite early, didn't they, in the care homes. But I don't know what that would have been like in other countries.
Yes, that was an example of, in the early stages of the crisis, the public and sort of small organisations were a couple of steps ahead of the government.
Right.
So the Premier League stopped doing football matches before the government told them to stop doing football matches. Right. The care homes closed themselves down before the government told them they got to close themselves
down. Yeah, I thought that came.
And there were lots of
sort of little examples like that of people thinking, well, we can't do this anymore.
No.
Because of COVID-19, yeah. before yeah. the government actually made yeah. announcements about,
yeah.
you know, yeah. you mustn't do it. I mean, the one that the government did make a big difference to was places of entertainment, the yes. pubs and restaurants and...
Yeah.
Theatres and, yes. and all that yeah, kind of thing. Right. They were yeah. still going until the government said, you've got to shut.
Yes, yeah.
But certainly the care homes, you know, our local care home here and the one my mum's in, had made announcements about the fact they weren't going to...
Yeah, that was early on,
they were
going
to shut down to visiting. Yeah. 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 Before, yes. Certainly before there was any announcement that they had to do so.
Yeah, yeah.
But this article's making the point about, you know, how the people who work in care homes, the staff are...
Yeah, they're not sort of funded,
no.
you know, properly, and or they're you know, run by individuals who own the place,
yeah.
and they don't, they're on low pay, and they're...
Well, they really struggle to take time off. Yeah,
yeah. yeah.
And the care homes themselves struggle to make ends meet.
Yes. and then some of them will work in two different care homes to earn the money.
Yeah.
And you know, increase the risk of passing on infection yeah. as well. So
because it's not a properly funded service,
no.
with poor sort of standards of employment and staff conditions and everything, it's an accident waiting to happen from the virus point of view.
Yes, yeah. I couldn't quite understand this thing up here about the Coronavirus Act.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, substitutes a minimal obligation not to cut support below the level required to maintain their most basic human rights.
Yes.
I think whoever wrote this was quite cross about this. He thought yes. it was not very good.
It is, a tough thumping yeah. piece. It's
yeah,
a,
it is.
It's kind of, you know, this is an absolute disgrace to our society.
Shouldn't be happening in this yeah. country, yeah. and then I think the...
I don't really know anything about the Coronavirus Act.
No, nor do I.
But what they're saying is that is basically it's it was like emergency legislation that, yeah. that took away people's human rights is what it seemed to be yeah, saying and yeah. saying that they just as long as you meet these minimal standards that's all you've got yeah. to do instead of them having legal rights to social care services
yes.
for elderly, ill, and disabled people in the community and in residential settings.
Yeah, I don't know.
So they no longer have a duty to meet all essential social care needs. Right. Instead of that, they just have this minimal obligation
yeah.
not to cut support below the level required to maintain their most basic human rights.
Yes.
So, as I say, I wasn't even aware there was a Coronavirus Act as such, but no. I certainly don't know the detail of it.
Well, it may be that the new things they're putting in place about the... You know, the obligations, you know, the National Health has got to look after people in care homes.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, something one of the local care homes here, the staff seem very committed.
Yes.
Yeah, and they're, you know, they do their best, definitely, yeah. and they seem to be very caring.
Yeah.
Which is a, you know, that's a positive thing, definitely.
Yes.
Even if they are getting paid poorly. Or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think there's a... I suppose it could be a bit of a, like this sort of, this is, you know, tough times, we've got to work together and all that sort of thing.
But I think there certainly is an element of that. Yeah. You know, people make a especially big effort because they're confronting an especially yes. big, difficult issue that yes. has to be dealt with.
Yeah.
And in
yeah.
some ways, I mean, you know, in some ways it's been kind of liberating.
Yes.
Because... You know, one of the first things that happened when the coronavirus crisis came along was they yeah. said, "We forget about QAF.
Yes.
Don't bother yeah, about QAF.
Exactly. Brilliant.
Forget about CQC inspections.
Yeah, right.
Don't bother about that for the duration." No. And that is very liberating.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But yes. one of the interesting things about it as it's gone on has been how different parties have used it
yes.
to push existing agendas.
Well, that's true.
So,
yes.
for example, we've had Dr. Link foisted
yes.
on us,
yes.
which is NHS England wanting to have this kind of, yeah. you know, e-consultation thing
yes.
in place.
Yeah.
And we've recently had to set up, or we're in the process of setting up GP Connect so that NHS 111 could book into appointment slots in the surgery, which again is something that was already on the agenda,
yes,
and they're using the coronavirus crisis as a lever to get that into place now. And now they've just brought forward this directed enhanced service for care homes, which again was on the agenda,
yes,
and there's been a lot of unhappiness about it,
yeah,
and now they're trying to sort of bring that forward because care homes are the new front for coping with the coronavirus.
Yeah.
We've got to get this directed enhanced service up and running now, So there's been quite a bit of that, people pushing their own agendas. I mean, if you look at, and as I say, if you look at like Boris Johnson, he wants to be Churchill.
Yes,
you look at Donald Trump, he wants to blame it all on the Chinese.
Yes, he does.
Or, whoever else. So people interpret the crisis and sort of manipulate it to their own ends to some extent.
Yeah, that's
they?
True. Yeah, yes, this is a good opportunity for us to get something done that we want to.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
Yeah. Well, I think that's probably enough.
I think we've put that crisis to bed.
I think we've probably cheered a lot of people up in the whole country.
or all the three people who actually listen to us. All right, well, thank you very much for listening, and hopefully we'll be back next month.
Hang on, let's get into switching off. There we go.